at the first moment when I walked in Kira's cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the third Scan On podcast of 2018. I'm Darren and joining me are...
Alex.
Jason.
And Roman.
And we're taking a look at the week in film, both ours and Ireland's and the larger world. So let's start with what we watched this week, gentlemen. So what did you watch, Alex?
I watched two Netflix films and then I went to Downsizing last night. None of which were particularly brilliant. But
I like how you're caging it.
Just
managing expectations.
What Netflix films?
Netflix films were The Polka King, starring Jack Black. Stupid and Futile Gesture, starring Will Forte. Yeah.
I thought then Jack Black, and then there's like a Stupid and Futile Gesture.
I thought
they would have done better.
harsh criticism. And then, as I said, Downsizing last night.
How were any good?
Yeah, I suppose The Polka King was interesting because I sort of like saw the trailer and was like, I'm on board. It stars Jack Black as Jan Levan, who sort of like...
He's Polish, isn't he?
He sort of took over the Pennsylvania polka scene in the...
And there was a Pennsylvania polka scene.
A massive Pennsylvania
you,
polka
you
scene.
You weren't there. Did you notice there?
The double P, if you will.
Yeah. Yes.
And... It was sort of like, I remember sort of hearing about it and seeing Jack Black is giving like a broad, natural libre style accent to Jan Levan and thinking, oh, this looks like a bit of fun. It's got Jason Schwartzman as his best friend, Mickey Pizzazz, and it's got Jenny Slate as his sort of beauty queen wife. And I was thinking, this has got everything that I will enjoy.
I like how you didn't have Jay on Jason Schwartzman, but you did on Jenny Slate. you could gauge the reaction across the room.
Indeed.
I think it is fun to an extent, but the actual story of Jan Levan, I should probably give a bit of detail on. So he was the Polka King of Pennsylvania.
I don't know why I'm here to tell him, but anyway.
He was very popular with sort of older crowds who loved polka, and there were obviously a lot of people who sort of descendants of Polish people in Pennsylvania at the time, so there was this big following. But he then decided to essentially start conning his followers into giving him money, and he set up this like massive Ponzi scheme. Eventually, so that's kind of where the film eventually goes, and it was funny, but it in terms of tone, it kind of jigged and jagged. You're watching Jack Black doing an accent and like dancing around with bears and all this different thing, and then you kind of like followed by a scene where he's just conning like a sweet elderly couple out of their life savings.
The tone sounds very strange.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's going for Bernie almost.
I was going to say that. It sounds like a weird subpar Linklater.
That's exactly it. I was sort of thinking, this is going to be like Bernie. This is going to be great. And it really wasn't. And it was because they just didn't nail that tone. It didn't know really how to deal with the like nastier aspects of the whole story. And I wouldn't completely like slate it. It was, you know, everyone's
Jenny Slate.
Or Jenny Slate. She's one of the reasons why I wouldn't completely, you know,
she's very, pretty great.
She's
actually,
pretty great.
Yeah,
and she's really funny in this. Yeah. There's a sort of point in the film where she sort of wants to get out of his shadow. She no longer wants to be Mrs. Jan Levan, and she starts entering like beauty contests. And there's this whole like funny then side story, and it comes out and sort of follows her. And yeah, so, you know, it just didn't get the tone right. It's, you know, you're watching him dance around and be funny, and then he's getting stabbed in the neck in prison, and you're like, whoa, well, this is a...
That's a tonal shift.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a lot of holes to poke in that one, eh?
Hey.
But anyway, so what was the other Netflix?
Sorry, the other one...
Stupid and Futile Gesture.
So it's sort of the biopic of this guy called Doug Kenny, who started National Lampoon with a guy called Nick Beard, I think his name was. And in the film, they're played by Will Forte, who I like a lot.
I do as well, actually.
And Donald Gleason plays. So the pair of them, despite being in terms of ages, I think Donald Gleason's like, you know, much younger than Will Forte.
Oh, okay.
But they kind of like, it's directed by David Wayne, who did, you know, he's done some of those sort of like comedy films. And I think the whole idea is that it takes a very sort of, in the way that Doug Kenny, the original Doug Kenny, who set up this magazine called National Lampoon to sort of, you know, take down sort of normal, stereotypical comedy and sort of do this whole new crazy thing with comedy and make jokes that were like pushing the line. This biopic tries to do some of that. It kind of like takes a little bit of an attitude of like, oh, all biopics are stupid anyway because you can't ever really totally convey someone's whole life in a movie. And it takes that attitude right from the start. It's sort of like listing things on screen that they've taken dramatic liberties with, and they have like the director at the start saying, like, you can hear his voiceover actually saying to Doug Kenny, you know, I want the opening line to be, you change comedy but you can never change yourself. And
This is kind of a sort of American Splendor-esque kind of.
Yeah, definitely an American Splendor comparison. And the cast, as I say, are really good. It just at a certain point sometimes feels that it's very in-jokey, and for a film that's kind of meant to be about like opening up comedy and like this whole, it's very in-jokey, and you're kind of looking at.
It's also in-jokey about a guy who most people know as a background character in Animal House.
Yeah,
that has been. He's like, he created National Lampoon, which means he's a big, you know, name to comedy geeks. Yeah. But outside of that, he's the guy who was in the background for that, you know, couple of scenes in Animal House.
And that's it exactly. Like, they actually show those scenes. They go really into sort of like his role in things like Caddyshack and Animal House, and. And his resentment of Saturday Night Live when it sort of came along and stole all his
I have a lot of resentment for Saturday Night Live.
And, but it's also done with this sort of like, it's a good sort of comparison to the other one, because in terms of tone, it's very conscious of its tone the whole time.
Yeah.
It's constantly trying to sort of never take things too seriously, much like he did. The only thing I always remembered about Doug Kenny before I had seen this film was that he actually died at a relatively young age. He died when he was 33 or something. They just found his body at the bottom of a cliff in Hawaii. And they didn't know if he had killed himself or if he had fallen. And Harold Ramis, who everyone knows is the director of Groundhog Day and was one of the Ghostbusters and all this, he was a friend of Doug Kenny's. And he said at the time, Doug Kenny was probably looking for a place to jump when he fell. And that was his description of that.
That's a pretty good line.
So, and the whole film is kind of like that. It takes a very sort of like, you know, it's a very sort of broad approach to his life. They're not really that worried about getting all the facts right. So.
I don't mind that.
I'd recommend
post-Walkhard, isn't it? There's that kind of
bio.
The less you do of the kind of traditional thing, the better for everyone.
You.
Like,
you need to have a drug addiction in there. You need to have a broken marriage. You need to have a screaming scene.
You don't want this.
There's literally a line.
And you never, not once, paid for drugs.
Yeah.
There's literally a line in where I think someone says the wrong kid died in relation to like his brother. And I was thinking,
that's a little bit on.
But the only criticism I'd have is it feels a bit in jokey. You kind of need to know a little bit about the characters. As you were saying, you knew he was the background guy in Animal House. And so you're watching the scene where he's the background guy in the house. And you're like, this is great. Whereas I think if you didn't know, like, oh, that's Gilda Radner. Oh, that's Bill Murray. This is great. You're not really in it.
Yeah.
So sometimes it feels like the comedians who are starring as all these comedians are kind of making it for themselves.
Yeah.
And that's the only criticism I'd say. But no, I actually kind of liked it. And yeah.
We'll probably get to talk about Downsizing when
Absolutely.
We get to the top 10 later. But Jay, what did you watch this week?
Downsizing made the top 10?
Wow.
Anyway, sorry.
Small wonder, eh?
Whoa, the joke starts.
It's already there.
Jeez,
we barely started.
I know.
Don't worry,
they're only going to grow from here.
Myself and Ronan may have a couple of overlaps this week, I think.
Yeah.
So I'll kind of kick off with one that we don't have. It's a film called Pariah, which is one of the earlier films of Dee Reese, who made Mudbound.
Oh.
She made this and Bessie, I think, which is the HBO kind of TV movie about kind of the olden day kind of singers. It's kind of, I think it's Queen Latifah. And I haven't seen that one.
And she did the season finale of Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams, Kill All Others with Fig of Mara.
Did she? She's done a bit of TV. I've kind of looked up subsequently, obviously, trying to pay the bills and whatnot. But
also modern television not being.
Oh no! I imagine she'd have to, like, it's a bit of work to get projects off the ground, so you might as well be working away anyway.
We're a bit of away from like doing one episode of Murder She Wrote to pay.
That's a fair point.
Yeah.
I would watch that episode. Though.
Well, William Friedkin end up doing episodes of CSI, which is kind of sad. Anyway, on that note,
Quentin Tarantino did,
but he did his own.
But in a like,
Tarantino.
Not like
I got a second mortgage.
All right, I don't want to divert into TV, but I take your point. No, Pariah is a story of a young girl in the kind of the black community who's basically a closeted lesbian, and kind of, I guess, coming of age in real terms. The structure of the film is kind of one you've seen before. It is that kind of literal kind of coming of age, but it's coming from a very, very community aspect of there is a kind of real stigma, particularly with women and I think black community coming out. And so it kind of gets at that and gets at, like, there's one of her friends who's kind of doesn't give a shit, like, she's out and that's that. So she kind of hangs out with her, but the parents obviously don't approve of her. They don't really know why they don't approve of her, or not consciously, but they suspect they might have an inkling of what's going on. But she's played by Adepero Ojuye, who I'd never seen before, and is absolutely fantastic in the main character, and she's really, really good. And it's a cinematography by Bradford Young, who he does such great work, and his close-up work here is incredible. And what the film does really good in that regard, both Reese gets it and Young gets it, is that it really gets at the intimacy of it, like the kind of the emotional kind of cost of what she's kind of wants to be and can't be, and how she can't kind of be herself in this regard, and then the kind of parental kind of, I guess, duplicity, because they're having their own troubles in their marriage, but they don't really kind of see their kind of daughter as having any troubles, or you know, why can't you meet a boy, you know, that kind of, it's that kind of story. But it takes a really, really kind of gentle, kind of intimate route through the film, which really works in its favour. It's not kind of hysteric. There's one big scene that you get where she does come out in a kind of family confrontational sense, and that's just the one big scene in the film, but it's not played like it. The scene happens.
It's not a big melodrama, sort of.
The scene is kind of somewhat melodramatic, but it's quite short, and it's not played after that for the big emotional beats that it could have been. Mm. There's restraint on board here, both from the filmmaker's perspective and the cinematographer's perspective. It's really well written. It's as I said, it's kind of familiar. The story beats would be familiar, but the telling of it and the kind of what it's shown in terms of community sense is not. And it's really, really good. I very much recommend it. Reese is a terrific filmmaker. Like.
She is.
Sad
to see it didn't get more Oscar level, though.
Mudbound.
Yeah.
I should have got a Best Picture nomination, in my opinion. But, you know, these are the way these things are.
Yeah.
Netflix and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of things going on in that regard. Like, that's another podcast, I suspect, about the whole Netflix thing and how these will go in the next few years. But the other one I'll mention, and I think Ronan would have seen this as well, is Red Road.
Yeah.
Andrew Arnold film, which I hadn't seen. And I bought him one in the HMV fire sale. Do you remember?
Was your first time watching it?
Yeah, I completely missed it.
Okay.
I bought it, you know, the HMV fire sale at the end of the year, where like you get like 10 Blu-rays and DVDs for like 10 quid. It was tragic. But I got such a haul. Yeah. I know, right? So it was like,
Jay's standing outside the
window. I feel dreadful. He said, I can pick some 400 Blu-ray. I did feel, I genuinely did feel bad, but it's like, but you were there, like, I might as well have them. So that was in the pile. I'd seen Fish Tank, which I really liked, and I'd seen American Honey, which I adored. So I'd wanted to catch up on the rest of it, and Red Road's in there for a while, so I had to watch it. Absolutely fantastic film and an unbelievable debut. Actually, he's so confident.
Yeah, as feature debuts go. Yeah, there's so much going on.
She knows, really knows what she's about. Like, there's a couple of things going on. There's like this kind of voyeurism second screen thing going on, which is basically like she's a kind of a person that watches CCTV and alerts the police or ambulance or whatever. In certain parts of I think it's Glasgow, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's these apartments, the streets of Red Road apartments. There's these massive blocks of buildings, like really. They're almost like characters in themselves in the film, aren't they? Like, they're really oppressive kind of look. They're high-rise, that kind of similar thing, except, you know, really good. No, I actually quite like high-rise. I'm afraid to rewatch it. But I kind of did.
I hate it.
I suspect I'll be able to rewatch it, so I'm not going to rewatch it. So
one
I'm just
of those films where I walked out, and in the lighthouse, they actually had the director coming in for the Q&A, and the lighthouse staff
you
for
punched
like,
them.
Can you just pretend you're going to the bathroom or something and not storming out?
Yeah.
Absolutely
like,
oh,
yes.
not. No, he's not.
Someone needs to tell him.
But anyway.
Otherwise, we'll just make Free Fire.
But it certainly had those...
Hey, I like Free Fire, and I like...
High Rise is better than Free Fire, and that's the same stuff. Right. But Arnold gets at this kind of thing of that kind of the kind of secondary voyeurism of the camera watching somebody watching the camera, watching people, and she has this unbelievably canny ability to dole out just the right amount of information for the viewer to get to watch to need, because there's a couple of things going on that cleared on. I was kind of almost leaning forward in my seat to want to know more. I don't know if you got that.
And that happens a lot with Kate Tickey. She'll lean forward and looking at
the screen.
Yeah, she's doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, it is. So you're kind of her in like a proxy sense. You're like, what is going on? But you're aware, obviously, she knows what's going on historically, but I don't. And then it also has this kind of beautiful kind of close-ups, intimate kind of close-ups all the time away from the screen, if you know what I mean, where you're concentrating on her or her family or the people she meets. So you move from the kind of distancing kind of cold kind of surface thing into incredibly intimate scenes, like and both in dangerous and kind of emotional kind of scenes. And then it kind of
I don't want to give anything away, because if you haven't seen it, I don't know who has. I know Ron's seen it, obviously.
It's a mystery, in effect.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
You don't know what's happening for so much of it.
Get a sense of where it's going. There's elements that kind of point you towards it. In retrospect, if I think about it.
But
it doesn't, even if you got it, you still wouldn't spoil the thing of it, because what it gets at is something much more profound.
Yeah, of course. And there's so much of it that's, I think, based in scenes of Kate Dickie alone. And there's so little dialogue that it's all, you know, it's a film of gestures.
Her
it's,
face gives away so much, like, and not at all.
The
way it's inscrutable.
The corners of her mouth, and it, everything about her performance is remarkable.
And she's very relaxed. The whole film is very relaxed. It's kind of, it has this naturalistic, and I know it's a Dogma kind of offshoot, wasn't it?
There's something to do with it, includes characters that have
to be
we're going to
do three films
with
similar characters. I think a second one was made, I think the third one was abandoned.
Yeah, I think
but,
so.
Like all the Trier's kind of weird kind of experiments and thing. But it was about bringing new directors through to do something with characters that are kind of established.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think there's a couple of kind of plots around it that don't necessarily matter
any sense
to the sense of it. They still kind of work in and of themselves.
But it absolutely stands up on its own. I'd actually forgotten about that. I knew that the first time I saw it, but watching it recently.
I'd only kind of read it up afterwards. Like, oh, that kind of makes sense a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, it kind of comes together very well at the end into a kind of beautiful and not at all over the top kind of revealing or whatever, if you want. It's actually quite naturalistic and quite beautiful, quite moving. And it comes to a kind of real interesting compromise point where you go, all right, I guess I can accept
and
that.
And it's got a really terrific final shot.
Yes, it does.
Really
I think Arnold's an exceptional filmmaker. I really do. And I can't, the only one I haven't seen of hers is Wuthering Heights, which I'm getting
to.
Hopefully, in the next few days. And so, as of hers.
Yeah,
but she's a magnificent filmmaker.
Yeah.
She's
gone from strength to strength. I was floored
by American Honey. Floored by it. So, yeah, get to watch. If you can get to Red Road, I'll lend you my 99 cent DVD.
It's also currently on Mubi still.
Yes.
Although, no, it may have gone the last couple of days. I think it was towards the bottom.
But
Ronan. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
My turn?
Yes, it is.
I watched a couple of interesting things this week. One I didn't particularly like that much, but was really interesting to see, was The Protagonist, which is Luca Guadagnino's first feature.
Yeah.
I think he may have made some documentaries and shorts before it, but it was his first film that went beyond Italy, certainly. Made with Tilda Swinton. It's a really strange docu-fiction thing, and it's kind of hard to disentangle it and figure out what's actually going on in it.
Okay.
So as far as I can make out from what I've read about it, it's based on a real murder case about a guy who was murdered in London, and Guadagnino and his team go to make a documentary, but then it's a film about them making a documentary, and it folds in itself in some really strange ways. It's beautifully directed. He really did an incredible job that you can see from that early in his career that he's got these great visual sensibilities, works really well with Swinton. I think it's a complete mess, to be honest. In the end, it doesn't really stack up. Not entirely sure what he's doing, the way he plays with documentary and fiction.
I'm never sure whether, when I hear the words docu-fiction,
like,
I think it's very difficult to do. I think I always kind of get a bit nervous about it, and I say, oh, Christ, please don't be terrible.
Well, what really kind of concerned me about this, and it's playing with this in really interesting ways, it's just that it's quite playful, but there is a guy who actually died.
And
that's very dangerous territory.
You told the family to get the interviews in the first place.
Yeah. It kind of raises some ethical issues, and I was very uncomfortable during it, which may well be the point. And it's really interesting in the way it elicits those reactions. But it literally ends with a gag reel of Tilda Swinton and co having a grand old laugh in a garden, and it's dedicated to the guy who's genuinely died.
Well, at least they did that.
But
it may be the case.
It's what he would have wanted.
It wasn't real, but from my research, I think it was a real case. It's very strange, but especially in the context of where his career has gone, really interesting to check out. Really strange film, but yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. I didn't enjoy it very much, but it was more interesting than anything else.
Yeah, it does sound fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It's really strange to grapple with.
Didn't you see The Imposter a few years ago?
Yes.
Thinking about, like,
I didn't like The Imposter, though.
Didn't you?
I'm a bit weird about documentary. I'm very traditionalist.
You're a purist, aren't you?
I really am. I don't like to be manipulated in the way that it's clear what's going on, but we're holding back the reveal kind of thing.
Something like Stories We Tell.
I really like Stories We Tell because I think it gets at something a little more naturalistic in it. I think it started off to be one thing, and it's more inquisitive than The other one that kind of threw me off is Searching for Sugarman, which I didn't like either for the same reason.
And you also found that's...
Yeah, because he wasn't fucking missing. He was playing away, and the filmmakers knew that.
Yeah.
They knew that, right?
Yeah.
He was missing in the context that people in South Africa, where he had a brief kind of popularity explosion.
Looking for
sin. They couldn't find him in the sense he had a turd there, but he wasn't lost.
Yeah.
He wasn't gone. He wasn't kidnapped by some fucking thing. And, I don't like when documentary filmmakers do this thing whereby they put things over here and then also you fucking know it's there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a narrative cheat as opposed. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I don't like that in a documentary. And I watch documentaries like a hawk these days, like, because a lot of them do it.
Nothing
like,
checks out.
Like, maybe so. Maybe. Well, I don't mind. Like, I haven't watched the Aaron Moore stuff. I heard that, and it's like, again, same with docudrama, kind of.
Yeah,
I like
the
Sarsgaard and all that kind of stuff, and I'm really forward to it.
Yeah.
And I know he knows what he's about.
Yeah,
so he's not going to be. It's going to be kind of clear where he goes with it, I would imagine. But I'm always kind of. I get really irritated and.
So, how do you feel about true crime podcasts? Is the next question.
Love them. No, sorry, I just. That's it.
Over it. It's good to get that out there, yeah. So, Ronan, what else did you watch this week?
Sorry,
another early film from a sort of bigger auteur these days, Kinetta by Yorgos Lanthimos,
which is his
film from before Dogtooth.
Oh.
Another one that was on Mubi, so it was The Guadagnino. It's, again, actually really interesting, but not very good in the end. It's got a lot of the early things that he would go on to incorporate, to the point, actually, where there are kind of plot points that pop up later. You know, there's a hotel maid, which kind of resonates with the lobster later on. It's a very strange story of actually very very similar to the protagonist in that way, in that it's kind of a film within a film is going on, and there's a director who's telling this actress to just act it, fight. It's really strange. It goes on for a very long time. There isn't that much interesting in it, but there's kind of a lot of early interesting direction from Lanthimos. He just really doesn't have anything to apply it to, but it's remarkable to see how he went from that to Dogtooth.
Yeah,
it's such a leap up.
So you get something out of your system.
Yeah,
that's a rough draft.
But
it really is. And very much so, watching Kinetta, there are several things that come up in his later films, so I think he knows that himself.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to see this film, so I can recite
it. He made one before, but it never went beyond Greece. Kinetta has sort of done some business outside Greece, but not very much at all.
I don't mind older films, though. Filmmakers obviously do grow, or good filmmakers do.
It's
always fascinating and interesting and informative to watch old films. Like, I'd never judge them on
you've
done something great, and you'll always find something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's what's really fascinating for a lot of filmmakers is how their later work responds to their earlier work.
Right?
One thing I caught this week actually was about half an hour of The Wolf of Wall Street, and I just really enjoyed watching it and being like, you know, the contrast between this and Goodfellas, the way Scorsese
he's
does that
stuff.
The way he plays off his older films.
Yeah.
Remember when I did that?
Yeah.
I could do that better now.
But it's almost refinement, obviously, kind of snooting it out of the
whittling away.
Cut it slightly faster with that song.
Yeah.
I did get Punch Drunk Love adds a bit to that as well.
Yeah.
Which is
one thing we saw last night in 35mm, The Lighthouse.
It does that kind of thing, and the beauty of editing in it, like, it's like an Anderson.
It's
like
the shortest Anderson film.
I always
thought
that was one that, like, it swapped. Like, it's, you know, Magnolia and Hard Eight and Boogie Nights, and then it feels like Punch Drunk Love, and he became like a different.
Well, that's the thing.
Like,
I think very much in the traditional sense of the word, Punch Drunk Love is his masterpiece. It's that where where he finds his own voice and starts doing his own thing. Because as much as I love Boogie Nights and Magnolia and, you know, Hard Eight to a lesser extent, they have that kind of thing where they're Boogie Nights is consciously emulating Scorsese.
Running
through both. But Punch Drunk Love, while it has other things that he's taken
it's
from
him,
filmmakers,
it is
very
much
him. And I think a huge part of that is that it's his first Johnny Greenwood score. And I think that's a huge part of him finding his style.
Incredible score.
The score,
like, and it matches Sanders' anxiety perfectly.
And the way
I came out in the cinema, and I've seen it a few times since. But even last night, it knew it made me feel like a pain in my stomach with anxiety of it. Like, and I remember it was like when you bust up the bathroom and
seeing with the sisters,
the phone calls him and he goes back and forth to the phone. It's like when he gets the phone calls from each sister,
the
cross-cutting
between Hoffman and both of them,
Hoffman. When you see Hoffman again, I miss Hoffman so much.
Breaks your heart, doesn't
it? Every time, it's like
wasn't he getting a haircut or something for that?
That terrific shot where he wheels.
I thought I warned you.
Silhouetted.
Yeah.
It's like this old western.
It's so terrific.
I enjoyed that so much. And the lovely thing about the entire PTA season that the Lighthouse has had is that the prints are battered.
Yeah.
They've been going around for 20 years.
I believe it's great.
Beautiful. Really lovely.
Anyway, that's great. I loved it.
So I watched Wild Strawberries, Bergman's film. First time I'd seen it, actually, because I've seen very little Bergman outside The Seventh Seal. Although, don't worry, I had seen Deconstructing Harry beforehand, so it just felt like I'd seen it. It's great.
One of the many Woody Allens doesn't just tip its hat.
It
steals the hat.
Stardust Memories, which is, he refilmed. But no, a very beautiful film. I've actually surprised Bergman, I'd always sort of figured as somebody, very cold, like stereotypical European auteur, sort of like meditate. And it is. Like, it's a, road movie where there's supporting characters who have a running argument about the existence of God in an uncaring universe.
Yeah.
But it's surprisingly fun and upbeat, which I actually really like.
It's absolutely on-brand Bergman, but there's a warmth to it.
I've never seen it. I've never seen most of it.
It's very,
what
very
I think
good.
Is absolutely incredible of that film is it was made the same year.
A Seventh Seal. And he also...
What? So that's your Jurassic Park and Schindler's List?
I don't know if I quite remember.
And he also directed for television. He did his first direction for television, and he had a nervous breakdown.
That's a good year.
By
anybody's standards, that's a pretty good year.
He actually wrote Wild Strawberries while he was recovering in hospital, while his third marriage was in decline, while his mistress, who would become his fourth wife, was also in the middle of a big argument, and he was like, okay, I'm 40 years old, I want to write a meditation on death.
So he had a busy year.
It was TV Seventh Seal Breakdown.
It was Seventh Seal TV Breakdown.
Okay.
Wild Strawberries.
Okay.
Just to cram it all in there.
It's a busy year.
It's a
phenomenal year. I mean, he kept working up until pretty much the end.
It's about film release, I think, 2002.
That is incredible.
When you think of Bergman as this institution of cinema, it's amazing. Yeah. And just how prolific he was, and also how he mingled. Because he also did TV and film at the same time.
He did,
back and forth. Before I got that, but I really
Prestige TV, if you will.
Before, well, it was Scandinavian.
No.
He did quite a lot of theatre as well.
Yeah.
He was a very busy guy.
And four marriages. It was...
he was getting busy.
Probably a connection there between,
really, really, really liked it. Also rewatched Logan in black and white because I wanted to see what that was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a film.
I do not buy or care for the black and white versions of films,
obviously it was shot in colour,
was
straight in
colour.
You've got to wonder what's the artistic purpose there? What's Mangold trying to say with
it? Well, it reminds me of, we watched The Disaster Artist, which documented The Room, and one of the famous things about The Room is Wazow, who knew nothing about film, was famously sold both film equipment and HD video. And he came up with the idea of filming the movie on both cameras simultaneously, despite the fact they both required different lighting setups.
Absolutely
visionary ahead of its time. As it turned out, obviously
he also bought them. They said normally people should rent these for 6 months. He's like, nope, I'm gonna buy them.
Especially if you're gonna make The Room, because you might not get to use the camera again.
It sort of reminded me of that, because there's absolutely no reason why the film should be in black and white, apart from the fact that Mangold apparently released a couple of black and white photos and people liked them. And
this is the internet. This is why I blame the internet for bloody everything.
That's a good point,
it looks great in black and white. Just watch black and white films, you fucking idiots.
Jay.
Oh, sorry. You can't just put noir on the film.
That's the worst part of it.
It is. Stop it. Just stop it, James Mangold.
You realize we're on the internet right now.
I'm not. I am unplugging myself as we speak.
Feedback on a postcard.
Yeah.
Send it by carrier.
I will meet you in any forest you want for a proper discussion.
But no, I first of all, I feel like there's some good good idea to make black and white something that millennials will watch.
But that's not black and white, though.
No, it's, no, it's desaturated,
isn't
it? It's,
yeah,
it's saturated.
You just literally turn.
That's,
okay.
That's the problem.
I could do that whole on every movie. Literally, I want to. I just take the colour of the TV.
Yeah,
why would you buy that?
The lead at the back of the TV is falling over.
There's a button on your remote.
I can literally just take the colour out like in a second.
Yeah. Now, I mean, there's an argument for... I do actually want to see the Mad Max one, because Mad Max is so heavily saturated that you get a nice contrast. The issue with Logan is in part that the film is very dark to begin with, very muddy, so you don't get blacks and whites. You don't get a clear contrast there.
Yeah. But I don't mind a clear... I don't necessarily need a clear contrast. I need a reason for it to be like it is.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it looks like. Do you know what I mean? Okay. It doesn't need. And Mad Max needs the colour. The colour in Mad Max is incredible. I don't care.
Okay.
He shot it in colour.
Shut the
and
fuck
it looks
up,
great.
George Miller.
Miller, what the fuck do you know about Phil Miller?
Yeah.
Sorry, I wouldn't go that far.
Okay,
apologies to George Miller. I want to apologise to George Miller. He made Babe, for Christ's sake.
And all
I'm happy with all three.
All three?
Did he make all three?
It's Miller time.
I've only seen one. I'll catch up with the rest forthwith.
The black and white versions.
No.
The Penguins look great.
Outstanding. Yeah, they would though, wouldn't they?
But yeah, so it's fine. So that was me. Logan's still a great film. Not entirely convinced the black and white was strictly necessary per se.
Was just to like clarify? Did he originally want to shoot it in black and white?
It was literally just
7-year-old daughter wanted his kind of thing. Like, can we see a black and white? And it's like,
no problem. Button on the remote.
It was literally. He tweeted out some pictures about, and I believe it's the shot of Hugh Jackman standing in the grass at night, which is one of the best shots in black and white.
But it isn't at always like Hugh Jackman standing somewhere in a low. That's kind of a bit, though, isn't it? Every film is that.
But this one was in black and white.
That's true.
What a radical idea it was.
But I don't like it. This is the only thing that really irks me, is that it's somehow seen as like more artful.
Yeah.
Do you know, as opposed to like.
Well, it's hipster.
It's that kind of bullshitty thing that I really like.
I think he's grasping towards being an auteur in a way.
And I don't like Mangold. I think Mangold's a decent director.
Absolutely.
Like, he's made some fine films.
Walk the Line's great.
Copland's great.
Copland's fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. All
right. Night and Day is a misunderstood masterpiece.
Tom Cruise one.
The Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz one.
Stop it.
It's the best Roger Moore Bond film ever made. There we go. There's a sell.
There's a poster quote.
I remember it being kind of creepy because he kept like knocking her out. Like she'd sort of wake up.
Like I said, the best Roger Moore Bond film ever made.
Or the worst Roger Moore Bond film ever made. Depending on which way you look at it.
Yeah. All right. But anyway, so let's take a look then at the news for the week.
Sure.
Do it.
So in terms of news, the Irish Film Board announced its slate or its plan for 2018. Which is good. You know, obviously we've had a really great year this past year, the Oscar nominations and stuff like that. Mm. In terms of what they've actually announced and what they're planning, 16 Irish feature films are planned, 5 creative co-productions, 5 television animations, 13 documentaries for Jay, 21 short films, all for Jay, 21 short films, and 1 major international television drama series. So it's actually quite an impressive sort of... quite an impressive across the board there.
That's great.
In fairness to Ireland,
it punches miles away
documentary terms.
Ireland
makes
not
some of the most...
Not just in terms of documentaries.
Well, mostly in terms of documentaries. We've got better at features in the last few years, but at documentary level, we've always been great at it.
Right.
Like, my favourite film, I think, of last year was probably The Farthest.
The Farthest was beautiful.
It's Niall's favourite film of last year as well.
Just like
I really
film,
liked
not
it.
Like
it wasn't
documentary.
Yeah, no,
Irish
it wasn't like me, but it's pretty great.
Yeah, I remember that there was actually an argument in some circles about whether or not you could classify that as a film. I think there was a large...
As a film?
As a feature film as opposed to a documentary. Whether or not you had to ring fence it for their end of year awards categories.
It was a documentary for me.
End of year award categories where there was a strong push for it as a feature film. And I believe there was some argument as to how it should be awarded.
Strange.
Should it be the best documentary or should it be among the best films?
We had to be both, though.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
it
can be one of the best films. That has to be a documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'd agree. I've had documentaries. Irish documentaries have kind of littered my top 10, 20 of the year for the last, I don't know how many years.
Yeah. Oh, no, it was, it wasn't, it was an Irish film, sorry. It was Pat Collins. Was,
yeah, but I mean, Pat Collins has been there in the mix pretty much every other time he's made a documentary.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we do great documentaries. Great documentaries. Always have done. Features, we've got better, we've got more consistent. Obviously, there's 16 film board films, but then there's other independent films that come out as well during the year.
Mm.
So there's generally a decent amount of Irish films. Like, there's probably one that's released every few weeks now.
Whereas that wouldn't have been the case even 3 or 4 years ago, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, wasn't, like, two of the biggest Irish films of last year were non-Film Board films, if I remember correctly. Like, Notorious technically is counted as an Irish film. That's
which?
The Colin McGregor one, for example.
Yeah, is that even a film? Yeah. Sorry. I didn't see it.
It's a documentary.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a docudrama.
Well, you were talking about how we punched our way to
the yes. Hoisted by my... Yes, that's true.
But yeah, so the supported output for 2017 was in excess of €84 million, which is quite impressive. 58% increase on 2016. They're actually working to expand outside of Dublin, actually, which is quite good.
What? Just an outside of Dublin?
Yeah. I think that's beyond the pale, Jay.
I've heard such rumours, but yeah. I don't know.
But yeah, so they're spending €46.7 million. Outside the pale, which is
that's pretty good, actually.
No, it is actually, because I mean, there are all over the
Yeah,
particularly if you're looking at, say, developing Irish language, because we talked on the podcast before about, like, if Ireland wants to compete at the Oscars, it may not be a bad idea to compete as an Irish
foreign
language
film
every year. Like, we should be there should be a proper one done every year. I've been saying this for years as well. Like, it's madness that it's not every year. Like, I mean, we should be competing at that level.
Cool. And Irish box office returns were up to €2.2 million last year, which is quite impressive. Up for
I think Cardboard Gangster's probably got about 20% of that, don't it?
Yeah.
That was a big film.
Yeah, it was like €500,000. And that wasn't a film or film.
And it was, that was
in the cinema, yeah.
Yeah, which
and it's an 80-inch film.
No support. Shot using
Cost nothing to make. Yeah. Like, I was very impressed by that.
Yeah, and quite an accomplishment as well. And a wonderful sort of celebration, like diversity.
Putting on
film these days as well. In terms of the total box office in the UK and Ireland was up to £1,379.3 million, up 3.7 from 2016. And the market share of independent UK films was 9%, with the share of US studio-backed and other inward investment UK and Irish films at 28%.
How does that rock out here, though?
Yeah.
That's got to be, like, the Irish box office to UK, or international box office in Ireland's got to be low.
Yeah, I suppose. I don't actually have the statistics.
I
was literally given a sheet.
No, I think Niall had mentioned something around in Ireland it's like 2%, and compared to the UK's 9% of their own films get seen.
All right.
We're quite a bit lower.
Yeah, I mean, it's not brilliant, but then you're stacking Irish box office against kind of like massive films.
Yeah.
Like,
we're not only stacking against massive films. Like, in terms of, like, we talk about spending money outside the pale to, like, invest in films.
Yeah.
In terms of access to cinemas and stuff like that, like, we hear constantly talking to people that, like, you can't see, like, medium budget American films in
Never mind Irish films. That's a very good point.
You're left only with multiplexes, largely.
Yeah.
You know,
you would have lived there. You would have different places.
Yeah, as a Corkman myself, you're dealing with in Cork city centre. There's one cinema which has something like the gate.
Oh.
In terms of multiplexes. In terms of full term cinemas. Which has, I think, 6 screens and will primarily show the biggest films, obviously.
Yeah. I was in Cork a few weeks ago looking for that Armando Iannucci one, The Death of Stalin.
You just have to sort of look at it.
You think that would be...
And there's 2 showings or something.
The thing. Triskel is the art centre there, which shows films. It'll show 2 films a week with 4 screenings each, generally. So it has 8 art house screenings a week in the second biggest city in the country, which is just
and serving
ridiculous.
It is, and I think we're very lucky in Dublin. You kind of forget that if you're,
you have access to 5 cinemas because you can't do drama as well.
Yeah,
but,
as somebody who's recently moved to Dublin, you know, I watched, was it 6 films in 35mm this month?
Yeah.
Just January just gone.
Yeah.
Which is more than I've ever seen in Cork. Because
you were saying
they don't do 35mm.
Yeah.
You're going down this weekend and you want to see the Phantom Thread.
Yeah,
but
I can't see Phantom Thread until next week because I want to see it in 35mm, and you just can't outside Dublin, which is incredible. And I think the Palace, it's just called now, which is opening in Galway sometime this month.
The Lighthouse owned one, isn't it?
Pictures, which has taken 9 years to set up, as we said.
10 million quid.
Obviously, it was in the midst of a very bad time to be building anything.
Yeah.
But it's taken so long to create, but it's going to be made without a 35mm projector, which...
Really?
Which perhaps...
All of that investment?
Yeah.
And not,
and
like...
How
can you spend €10 million and not have a 35mm projector?
It'll do great work in bringing certain films to Galway and get there otherwise, but not
but
necessarily...
But that makes no sense.
And the retrospective, it doesn't have the capacity to do the kind of retrospective...
And what about, like, the Galway Film Festival, like the flat?
Yeah,
like, surely there's
going to be
Prince as
well. Yeah, they're going to make great use of it. But Prince, they haven't shown Prince.
I hope they rectify that. It's a shocking lack of foresight.
It really is. That's what worries me, that, you know, even when we do invest in promoting and preserving film culture, we don't necessarily do it in ways that, you know, preserve the key aspects of it.
Oh, certainly.
It's like, oh, they've got somewhere to watch movies.
Something
now,
beyond the nod to
the,
like,
existence.
Listen,
of,
there's cinema seats. You're in front of a screen.
Yeah,
what the hell's wrong with you? Like, I mean, there's a lot more to it than that.
There really is. Yeah.
Popcorn.
Well, yeah. Well, of course. Most of the same.
But yeah. So there's. Although we were talking earlier about a service that will be available for film fans in the UK and possibly Ireland.
I'm hoping Ireland. That Filmstruck.
Yeah.
Which is one of the major new kind of streaming services in America, which is a kind of TCM Criterion. Turner Classic Movies, which is a different thing than the TCM we get, which is crap.
Yeah,
but they get
really
a proper curated.
Hey, my dad loves
film.
Our TCM.
Oh, no,
thank
listen.
You very much.
And you get an occasional Western that's great, and
yeah,
whatever. Like,
yeah.
I know, I argue with that. But
I think
it's
more you just get a lot of John Wayne.
If you follow any kind of American film people that watch TCM, there's curated seasons and all sorts of. Really rare, ultra rare. Richard
Brody, the
New Yorker, writes a lot of them, constantly remind people about
TCM now
because such and such
film
that he's not available on DVD and it's whatever. It's a great thing. So they came together with Criterion to launch a kind of channel for kind of pretty much art house kind of film fans. $99 a year for the full Criterion, which is an incredible value. I've heard and I've been given instructions on how to get it here. A few months back, and I was in the middle of skipping.
Careful,
and never
Jay,
got, no,
this is
no,
going
no.
on the record.
Listen, you can get it, apparently. It requires a bit
if
of work.
If
you really want it. But now that it's launching here, the UK, I presume we'll have access to it. I haven't investigated yet. It's only just come out today.
The
kind of launch details of it.
Yeah.
If that's the case, I don't know what kind of Criterion they'll get. Curzon are the kind of partners in the UK who run their own kind of
their own art house stuff. Yeah.
They do their own cinemas
like
in the UK.
Baby, for example,
yeah, and they release a day and date release in the UK, a lot of that kind of stuff. So you can get to see new films at home if you're not local, which is great because a lot of regional cities wouldn't have cinemas and similar events
there,
earlier.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
But,
most people complain about Netflix and the existence of streaming services and the death of cinema as an art form. Like, the fact that you have these channels of access is.
It's a lot better than it used to be in that regard. But, I mean, something like Filmstruck, if it is good as the potential it has, if it is that good, then we're really spoiled here because that's really top-level stuff. I suspect it won't be. I imagine there'll be rights issues.
Yeah.
So you won't get a lot of what you get in America. But we'll see. I mean, time will tell. But it's an interesting time.
It would be.
Because I'm certainly all over it. I think it's £60 for a year with 2 months free. I think
so
the original price back.
Months,
or you can buy £5.99 a month. That's sterling, so...
Why would you do that?
I don't know why anybody would do that. But, we'll talk about it in the next few weeks if it kicks off.
If
we can fully access it.
If all of a sudden Jay starts talking about Criterion releases at the start of these podcasts, you'll know that the subscription's going well.
Yes, indeed. But I will mention that. For a fee.
the new sponsor of the podcast.
Yeah, yes.
We can
Criterion Collection.
I think that we need... better criteria for some
indeed.
But is there anything else from the week in film that anybody would like to talk about? Anything that sort of jumped out or anything that came to anybody's mind?
One before we go on, and I don't know if anybody's been reading up on it, the release of Annihilation.
Yes.
That's
the Alex Garland
film.
Yes.
Well.
Yeah.
Really interesting in terms of Paramount's. Paramount,
the Hollywood
Paramount
Reporter.
Woes. There's a story today, I think, it was released about it.
The Atlantic and the Hollywood Reporter got sort
kind
of both sides, but
it's... And it's kind of a... Paramount got cold feet about being a little too intellectual, is what I read.
And you want to know what's remarkable, though, right? One of Paramount's biggest successes the past couple of years, like out of nowhere in terms of budget and return, was Arrival, which is an intellectual science fiction film starring a female lead. And you would have imagined that looking
how
at that...
How do we market that?
Yeah.
Let's not market this way.
Yeah. Apparently, because, you know, Paramount's had a lot of trouble recently financially in terms of they are arguably the only studio without a major franchise outside of Mission Impossible.
They have got Transformers.
They have got Transformers.
But that's
not
they're not,
that's,
even,
that's
they're not
decline,
even films.
But that's in decline now.
They had The Last Night.
So they've got only two big tentpoles this year, which are obviously the Bumblebee spin-off from Transformers.
The Bumblebee spin-off.
But this is how bad things
Yay!
Are for Paramount. This
Finally, Bumblebee gets its time to shine.
Its moment in the sun. I'm sure there's a lot of buzz around it, though.
Yes, indeed.
But
they also have Mission Impossible, don't they?
They do Mission Impossible 6 starring Henry Cavill's mustache.
Yeah.
I would love it
I'm
after
sure
all
be
the
fine.
Woe that caused... Cavill has the mustache for one scene, and the next scene is him shaving it off. Yeah. But yeah, so this is the situation Paramount's in, is that they don't have any
tentpoles
to build them around. And if those films go under, there's speculation that they may be like next in line for buyout. There's talks of remerging them with CBS.
But didn't this like Annihilation cost like 35 million?
Yeah, that's what's weird.
Like,
it's
not as if it's like they spent Blade Runner money on it.
And you also
know like in a kind of, you know, that silly way that studios spent 150 million. It's like, what the hell have we done here?
Oh, don't worry,
like,
we'll talk about one of those when we get to the top 10.
Oh, no, dude. But do you know what I mean? Like, it's like 35 million quid in an art house sense with actors you've heard of. With some kind of special effects-y kind of thing.
Yeah.
You think sells itself
in
to some degree.
March, when there's, or in February, when there's nothing
I'd heard
in cinemas anyway.
There was a story that they tested it.
Yes.
And that did a cold feat then kind of set in. I think that's
the They also had an issue with the new Cloverfield movie, The God Particle, which nobody's seen.
Which
film? The new Cloverfield film. So, you know, like 10 Cloverfield Lane?
Yes.
Netflix might have that.
That's it, exactly. They sold the international rights.
So, Annihilation and that could turn up on
Netflix. Chopping off their sort of like these small science fiction films and selling them off. Apparently, part of it may be down to a change in management.
Of course, the last management was considered disastrous.
Was sort of pushed out the door with films like, again, you're talking about investments, including like Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah.
To give you an example of, there we go. So there's a sense of like wanting to distance. Like with Disney, with John Carter.
Yeah.
Which was reportedly at least part of the reason that film got as screwed as it was, was because it was seen as sort of falling between.
Also, because he spent about 200 million on it or something, I would imagine was also a problem.
Yeah, first thing Jay would come in is cut the catering budget.
It is.
If
you're
going to
do
an
original
project,
you'd want to be very careful about how much you spend on it. I mean, if
you
ever rewatch the original Harry Potter film, the effects are shoddy as all hell.
Yeah.
And obviously,
they
obviously, but like, you've got to test the water a little bit. Like, you've got to do due diligence on what your audience may expect to see.
It's weird about the Annihilation one that, you know,
they
know what they're getting here.
Yeah.
They've hired the Ex Machina guy to do another variant on a sort of sci-fi arrival thing, and then they were like, oh god, guys, this isn't.
It's an intellectual science fiction movie with a female lead.
And it's.
Who could have seen
this
coming?
Surely you don't have a slate. Why not keep it on? You've got nothing else.
Yeah.
What else have you got that
already,
right to
they've
cheer?
Already paid for it.
Because 10 Cloverfield Lane did very well. And like Arrival did very well. Arrival did very well even awards season.
Yes.
And again, Arrival was another one that they sold off the international rights on as well. Like, you have to wonder like what the logic is that's happening behind the scenes.
It might be a previous management issue.
Sort of like a throw that.
Yeah, we'll start again. Yeah.
We'll start again with Henry Cavill's mustache and Bumblebee.
But they're probably right to do it with Mission Impossible because it seems somewhat indestructible in
that
sense.
The franchise is.
Yeah, yeah. It's
can't get enough of those films.
Yeah, so I mean, it's going to make money.
Barring two.
Two is
Two was a 2.5-hour shaving
a misstep,
commercial.
Yeah, but.
Sorry.
We'll be tired. Sorry. Good luck to them. I see trouble in their bits. But I mean, Netflix will benefit.
Oh, yeah.
Really. They'll know how to kind of throw it on the day without telling anybody.
And Netflix are quite happy to put up a lot of money for any kind of theatrical
crisis.
That's it.
Yeah.
And this is fantastic because, what you're talking about, like access to these films and stuff. Like, more people will see, and Garland has talked to this. Garland is a little disappointed because he made the films before
big
screen. But he understands that putting it on Netflix will mean that more eyes will actually see it, which is remarkable. The same thing's true of us, because I actually think about this with regard to the Oscar nominations and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mudbound, which got, it got fairly decent representation in terms of Oscar nominations. But like that is probably more accessible to most American moviegoers than The Phantom Thread or Darkest Hour or Lady Bird. It's easier to go and see like Mudbound than it would be to see most of the Best Picture nominees.
And the fairness on Netflix, like before we kind of, like they're the usual kind of go-to clickbait article to kick around the room, like.
Yeah.
They're also funding new Charlie Kaufman film.
Which
he struggles almightly to get funded.
Yeah.
Like,
which is,
you know, I mean, I'm not saying they're perfect. I'm not saying their distribution doesn't work out, but they're doing something.
Before the end of the month with his Duncan Jones not doing Warcraft.
Though I think it is worth emphasizing that, you know, Netflix aren't doing that because they're like, ooh, Charlie Kaufman fans are really hungry. They're doing it because their data tells them that this is probably.
But I don't care, though.
No, I don't care.
As long as Charlie Kaufman's getting work.
I love the idea of Netflix sort of sitting there going, Jay is happy.
I would like to think Netflix thinks that way.
Wait for that 1 5-star review to come rolling in.
I think what's interesting, though, as well, is particularly when you
have to work for it.
Paramount and.
in the context of Paramount, back in the day when it was sort of like Robert Evans, let's throw money at the conversation, let's throw money at the Godfather, these weird things.
Chinatown.
And Netflix are now doing that to an extent. They're taking risks on really strange things some of the time. That film I mentioned earlier, A Stupid and Futile Gesture, I remember watching that and being like, there's no other way this was ever getting made other than like a bunch of comedians who wanted to do it and Netflix said, sure, we'll give you a little bit of money. But then I think the same is probably true of, like, at what point do Netflix go mad? At what point do Netflix make Heaven's Gate? You know what I mean? At what point do they, like...
Well, you could argue they did, though, with The Get Down, which cost maybe 200 million. Like, it cost, like, there's eight episodes with 200 million.
The issue is they don't have to make Heaven's Gate because, Amazon have. Like, Amazon are basically have been culling their original series. Like, they killed I Love Dick, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone's going to mourn the loss of Jean-Claude Van Johnson. You know, they've culled this sort of, like, weird, quirky thing that they had going for them. Mm-hmm. Like, what was it, the one with Tig Notaro?
One Mississippi. Yeah, but they're doing that because the old management, and there's issues at Amazon that go beyond film in terms of... The Me Too movement and stuff like that. So there's a bit of a thing where they're going...
I don't think they're cancelling Jean-Claude Van Johnson because of the...
But there are shows. There were shows in production with David Russell. There were shows in production with the Weinstein Company and Woody Allen and stuff like that that have been shelved. And millions have been spent on already.
Yeah.
You'll never see... Like, apparently there's like 10, 15 million quid spent in the David Russell one for it.
So you're talking about Heaven's Gate, right? Because that was it. That was the one with Robert De Niro, right?
Yeah.
It was the most expensive
TV show ever made. I'm so happy about that. I was like, oh, no more David Russell travesties.
Why would that have rustled your feathers?
But it was a TV show. They were Amazon making it. Yeah.
There was no real concept in answering that. It was just, we have Robert De Niro. We have David O. Russell. And it is the most expensive TV show that will ever be made.
I think it won't be made. It's been pulled because something emerged with him.
Oh, because Russell. Russell's, really? Have you not heard about Russell?
I think he's
Russell is on the list.
Oh.
Yeah.
Also, he's always come across an asshole.
I mean,
let's not go full Paul Schrader on this. There is a real crime against Dublin.
Yes.
It's the one that we're worried about.
Dublin Film Festival picked a bad time to have Paul
Schrader. Do you reckon that's
or a great?
Why is actually?
Do you reckon somebody's sitting there in the Dublin Film Festival office, just like constantly searching his name on Twitter?
Because there was a little bit of a bump there late last year about he brought a Facebook.
The worst sex crime that Harvey Weinstein has ever
was cutting
my movie.
Yeah. So I remember reading that going, Dublin Film Festival, what are you doing? But he seems to have steered clear thus far.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Let's see if he holds out to the end of the month.
But yeah, talking about Heaven's Gate and Netflix, I kind of think that it's almost as if you have to magnify that because Netflix now have so much money pouring into almost everything.
Yeah.
I think it's got to be something that we haven't even imagined yet in terms of like the Heaven's Gate for Netflix. Because it's true, they you know, Martin Scorsese's been trying to make a film about Jimmy Hoffa for years, but no one wants to, you know, touch it. And you kind of think,
there's 100 million.
That's a gangster, you know, that's Martin Scorsese. That's
Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, even late career stage.
Yeah, you think that could, but no one else wanted, but Netflix.
Paramount, again. Paramount.
The funny thing about that is how much money The Wolf of Wall Street made. So it's not as if he's coming off like the fact
that 20 years of
I know silence. Silence, is a, silence is a reward for The Wolf of Wall Street in the context of
Silence is a film he was sued into making.
Yeah, like, that's all. God, what a waste. But anyway, but do you know what I mean? Like, it's like the guy in this area. If you, I'm not saying Wolf of Wall Street is necessarily a gangster film, but he certainly has.
If you're trying to say gangster films, there are other examples.
What I'm saying is,
you don't have
that's
to
a
say,
modern
like,
version of the kind of similar, not template,
it's
but
clear
it's,
that he
yeah,
can still do it.
And make money at it.
He's like fire in his belly.
That's
and
all
he's
it
still
is.
Making things. And
the studio should be funding that. And if Netflix are stepping in, then studios have to look at themselves, and it's not doing Netflix.
But this is my other point. That's certainly true. But I'm also wondering at what point do, you know, and Scorsese, obviously, someone who would have come up in that original wave in the Paramount 70s and all that. But then. In terms of that creative control, in terms of like do you think the Netflix executive is telling Martin Scorsese what to do?
No.
Exactly.
But then they get the prestige of having Scorsese
exactly.
on the thing, which
so
is really
this trade-off. And that's why I think it's going to grow, and the Scorsese one will probably be good, it's good hands, but what's the one after? Where is this going? Well, who's going to
Legendary
be the one?
Legendary director
to, like,
Zack Snyder.
Yeah.
But the thing about Netflix, I think they seem to be developing partnerships, and I think that's where they're going to go. Like, I see something like Mudbound, I can see in the next few months an announcement. Lee Reese is going to stay with Netflix and produce X amount. Kaufman, maybe, if the thing comes happens.
We'll oversee a slate.
Even in TV terms, they've heard, they've made a partnership. What's her name? That makes How to Get Away with Murder.
Shonda Rhimes.
Which is like
Shondaland.
And she's, yeah, exactly. Does these shows that are huge in America. So they're like, okay, we want to get into business with these people.
What they crucially want to do as well is to create this massive slate of content that appeals to as wide a base.
Yeah, because they're going to have to pay for anymore.
Coming along,
well,
they're taking everything away.
That's it. All the studios want their own.
This battle is moving online. Studios are going to move online themselves.
Yeah. And the thing about Netflix, when they did their original streaming deals, is nobody really knew anything about streaming. So you got everybody for a song. Yeah. But now everybody knows the value of their content. They want to make their own. It's an interesting time. Like, Amazon spending like probably 400 million on the Lord of the Rings, which has already been made.
And you know,
I'm no Lord of the Rings fan, but I can concede that it's probably as perfect a version as you'll ever get of Lord of the Rings. So why would you not just get another fantasy thing?
Bezos wants
Game of Thrones.
So prepare for Hobbit.
It is a wide mythology
that you can
pull so much from. So
there it is.
It makes sense in that regard.
Yeah,
and also,
I know.
Shared universe.
Bezos has money to burn.
Oh, they do. And it's never ended. And that's before Apple get into the game. They're on the verge of getting into the game now. So
it's an
interesting
time.
All right. Well, with that in mind, then we may move on to the top 10.
We may.
Oh, thank you, Jay.
That's all right, Harry.
At number 10, Darkest Hour.
You know,
I'll leave that to Roland.
What more have you seen?
I've seen it
accidentally.
I Twitter sourced it yesterday. Everybody said to me to go to the pub instead, so I did not see it.
Okay. Yeah. I think Darkest Hour isn't very good at all. Gary Oldman gives a very shouty performance. It'll get him into his Oscar, and he may do a Pacino on it and not stop shouting for another 20 years. But my concern about it is that, you know, it's fine that it's rubbish. Forget about it. But it's also, like, in terms of its politics, it's worryingly...
Well, I mean, we were talking about this. It's been in the top 10 for, 3 weeks at this point, so we can probably talk a little bit about
now,
that.
Is this the film or Churchill's politics?
Okay.
No.
That's a different podcast.
The way the film deals with it, there's a scene particularly late in the film, which is the worst scene in the film for reasons both dramatic and...
This is the subway scene.
This is the subway scene.
The infamous. I haven't seen it. I've had five people, I think,
and I've heard about people.
It is actually a remarkable scene. It's one of the scenes
stunning.
From 2017 I will not forget.
Yeah,
but not for good reason.
One of those ones where you're staring at the screen and you take it in awe because happened. A bunch of actors were assembled and they read these lines.
No one said no. So they wrote it, they shot it, they edited it.
And nobody said, hang on, lads.
Because
it is. It very much it glosses over the idea of like Churchill as who Churchill actually was.
But I think what kind of interests me about Darkest Hour, which is very little. That interests me, and you know, when I'm talking about the politics of it, I don't really care about the whole Churchill thing. It's the way it relates to the current moment. I think Darkest Hour is very much a Brexit film.
Really?
And I don't want to get into this whole thing of, you know, any film that comes along going, ooh, it's the film of our time. But with Darkest Hour, it's really interesting that the way that film winds up, its message in the end is, look at this great hero of British politics who, despite what everyone told him, carried on what he was doing in Europe. And everyone said it wasn't a good idea, but it worked out bloody well for him, didn't it?
But carrying on what he was doing in Europe. Like, there's a lot there.
Well, yeah.
Churchill's big argument is that the film is
a stopping point, though, surely. That's the point, isn't it? It's a Don Simpson freeze frame. If he says this and the film stops there, then it's like, it's uncertain. Yeah. So if he went this way, why not?
One of the film's central theses, though, is that like
about him. It is hero worship in the extreme, and I think
what
it's
is
very,
hero worship?
It's very much going. Okay. You know, this is the spirit of the English character, and we must carry on with this. And I think the subway scene is really interesting in that regard. In that, that's the point. And you know, it's the important thing about it is that it never happened.
It never would have happened.
No, of course not.
And particularly because, like, for example, there are like women and men of African extraction and Churchill engages with them as if he
recklessly contribute to genocide of.
Yes.
That scene is much more related to the current moment than it is the early 1940s, because the whole point of that is, well, everyone around him in the government is telling him not to do what he's doing, but the common man on the train said to do it, which is very Brexit.
Yeah,
when
that's worrying, because that's
that's your populism.
I think it's a very propagandic film. Yeah,
I
never want to see it again.
you never saw it once. Yeah, you never saw it.
No, I want to see it. I didn't want to see it. Now I want to see it again.
Oh, okay. You wanted to see it. You didn't want to see it. Now you
yeah,
want to
yeah,
see
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
There's the three stages of Darkest Hour.
Yeah.
there's all that going on to really worry me. And then there's, you know, Gary Oldman trotting around the place making jokes about toilets. And it's like, you're so much better than this.
He seems to be under a lot of makeup.
Yeah.
And fat suits and all that kind of...
Can we be sure it's him? We can hope it's not.
Twists in the best.
He's getting the Oscar, aren't you?
Hands the Oscar to someone else.
Actually, Timothy Chalamet. Sorry.
I could live with that.
All right, at number 9, a new entry. Downsizing.
Yay.
Speaking of Paramount.
Hit us in, Alex. Yeah. Paramount's Great Slate. What do you got?
How many annihilations could they have made for this?
I think at least 2 is the answer. Yeah.
We both saw it on the same night, actually.
We saw it last night. Still kind of fresh in my head. I'll say this. It's the worst Alexander Payne film, I think.
I don't think anybody will contest that.
But
what else is in the category? About Schmidt, maybe?
I like about Schmidt.
Just to illustrate.
That's what I mean. I don't think there's any Alexander Payne I don't like.
That's what I mean.
Well,
I'm
hold
a bit
on.
Lukewarm
the
on
Descendants,
the
maybe,
I'm
is about
quite
good.
Yeah, I didn't love the Descendants. But what I mean is, it's in many ways it's a mess of a film. Mm-hmm. It's also like 3 different films in terms of tone.
It's only 3,
and there's a lot of weird stuff going on in it. But part of me, and talking about the Paramount and the $70 million, part of me likes that a studio still gave someone who comes hot off Nebraska, which was actually in black and white and had Will Forte and didn't have much of a plot in terms of like,
I really like Nebraska.
And I love Nebraska.
Yeah.
And
we're doing
70,
a science fiction epic,
yeah.
but it costs $70 million.
I don't mind giving Payne money. Like, Payne's a good filmmaker.
But that's what I mean.
He can have a misstep. Like,
so,
you know, it can.
It doesn't pain you too badly.
I've only seen the trailer and it was more than sufficient, I think.
But that's the thing. I like Payne, but I have just run a mile from going anywhere near the film. There's something about it that I'm just like, no.
I don't even
want to
watch it at home. That's rare for me.
How does the player watch it? Because it looks as if it could be something he dusted off and was like, maybe I'll make this.
That's the thing.
I think
part of it, it does feel like it was a movie that was written almost, again, in 3 parts. I feel there is a very sort of almost intense, angry film about divorce in there.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, it becomes a film about kind of aging and your place in the world.
And then middle America being squeezed.
Yeah.
And then how, you know, everybody always oppresses a class.
Exactly.
And then environmentalism.
Yeah.
And then apocalyptism.
Yeah.
And then midlife crisis.
Yeah.
Like, there are several points in the film where I was like, oh, so this is what they're doing.
Yeah.
This could be interesting. And
jarring.
Before I hit the G on the end of it, the film had changed direction. There's a moment that spoils nothing in the film.
It's where spoil away
a bunch of characters sit down opposite a supporting cast member and say, now I've got to go to Norway.
Hmm.
And,
and you were not remotely surprised.
Your reaction there is the same as like the audience's reaction, given what we know is happening in the film so far.
Yeah.
So this is happening now.
I won't completely condemn it because there are a lot of good ideas in there. It's just there's so many and they're all mixed up and it doesn't ever really settle on one thing.
And it's got tone issues as
well.
Like, it's
massive tone issues.
Can I ask, from the trailer, it seems to certainly infer that there's this white hero narrative in some poor area of...
Oh yeah, there's some really uncomfortable racial stereotypes.
I remember looking, I was like, really? And Matt Damon, really?
It's not so much Matt Damon as the character he interacts with.
Well, I was also going to say that Alexander Payne is actually perfect at sort of chronicling mediocre white men.
I'm not arguing that. Yeah, that's
so,
a fair point. That's
and I actually think, and I will, again, to defend this film to a certain extent, I do think it's miscast with Matt Damon. I think the original choice was Paul Giamatti, and I remember thinking
it would work better
with that kind of character.
Yeah.
But part of that sort of the narrative, and he certainly does end up, is that he, in this particular situation, to sort of contrast, he sort of meets this character who's arrived at the exact same place as he has, but through a completely different way. And it's almost as if he was going through his life thinking, I've made the worst decisions in the world. And then through that, you kind of realize, no, he's actually one of these sort of sad, mediocre Alexander Payne men who...
Except, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, because it looks like it's going in that direction.
And then
it
changes into
something. It does. It looks like it's going to be like Election, which is this wonderful sort of, like, you think you're sort of vaguely sympathetic to Matthew Broderick.
Realize,
And then he just keeps digging.
Yeah.
And there's an element of that where you think downsizing is going in that direction with Matt Damon's character. And then it swerves.
Yeah.
And it's a hard swerve.
Yeah.
It is a very... And you can point to the moment where it swerves. And it tries to be cute when it's swerving, and you're like, no, don't do this.
I think they came up with a... relatively clever idea. Like, the actual, and it's kind of funny because it opens, the film opens with like a PowerPoint presentation about somebody like presenting, and to anyone who doesn't know what it's about, it's essentially about people being shrunk down to 12 inches high. But, you know, it never gets into the science of it. It just shows sciences pulling levers like from an old Frankenstein movie.
I don't mind that either in some way.
I thought that was great. Yeah. And it's almost as if then the shrinking is just the background. And it's even towards later on in the film, somebody will walk in holding something big and you realize, oh yeah, they're small. Yeah. You know, it's almost as if they kind of...
Well, it's one Matt Damon's character sort of mentions that. It's like, you know, you think you're in the real world and then every once in a while something happens. So like,
but I don't
you'll see
that.
Like a piece of grass or
if,
a butterfly.
If you can foreground something interesting, that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But if you don't really know what you're supposed to be...
It's also 2 hours and a quarter long, which is unforgivable. The cut shown at the film festival was somewhere around 2:40, I believe.
What?
Yeah.
Oh god!
And a big movie about small people.
Oh god!
It just never settles on being one thing. So
I
wouldn't completely condemn it because
hard pass.
It is interesting, and if you like Alexander Payne movies,
I do
a lot to like.
Okay,
but I was kind of interested to see that he was going after this high concept because you know he doesn't generally. He just goes for
maybe he just a shot the title like they're giving me money, let's do it.
Yeah.
Remember that script that you saw read years ago on top of shit? I'm fucking doing it. 70 million, baby.
But that's what it feels
Matt
like.
Damon. It feels like pretty much like he sent it into Paramount. Paramount said no, and then he sent Matt Damon in holding.
Oh, there's your money.
Yeah.
What if I swap Paul Giamatti for Matt Damon? And I think that's why it doesn't work. If this had been, no pun intended, a smaller film about... You know, somebody going through this process.
A slope kind of.
Exactly.
And
then a sort of like reassessment or a midlife crisis
like a
and all those things.
Film
and
It could have been
that's
great.
A film I already want to watch more. Which more than. I want to watch that. Like,
Apology to Maddie and Charlie Kaufman.
Matt Damon's miscast. He never really decides what he's doing. Not a complete disaster, but a bit of a mess.
Yeah, I might catch it on TV at some point.
Yeah, that's what I'd say. Catch it on TV.
At number 8, Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. Now on 2.5 million euro at the Irish box office.
God help us.
You know what always got me about that, and I haven't seen it? The Rock was in a film called Welcome to the Jungle.
Yeah.
About 12 years ago.
Everyone
just forgot.
He's going around.
This is the great injustice of Jumanji.
One of the casts of Jackass or something? They're going
around. Yeah, it was him and Sean William Scott or someone, possibly.
Oh, yes.
I remember seeing it years ago.
I always remember it because there's a scene at the start where The Rock goes into a nightclub, and on the way out, Arnold Schwarzenegger walks past him and just says, "Hey, have fun." And it was like this sort of
passing
of
the torch.
Jesus, okay.
But hey, don't worry, we still have King Conan to look forward to.
Oh, right.
Oh, God, help us all.
I'm actually really looking forward to that.
I don't know.
Okay.
Arnold's done some interesting things in his comeback, but I don't know if Conan's...
Maggie.
Was that the flight... one.
No, Maggie
the
is
zombie
the daughter.
One.
Zombie. I love that. Like Schwarzenegger's late stage career can be described as the noun one.
Yeah.
I like The Last Stand. That's all I got.
The Last Stand is
it's
a lot
really
of fun.
Good, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I like The Last Stand.
I was shocked how much
the
I liked it.
The one where the drug dealer's going to Mexico.
Yeah, and it's like
on
a
bunch.
But it has this kind of
really
downhole, and it's kind of gruesome and kind of real nice heft to it. I like it.
All right then. At number 7, The Commuter.
I've seen it.
Liam Neeson on a train.
I briefly thought about seeing it yesterday in my kind of I see.
It's much better than
Darkest
Hour.
I bottled it and just went to the pub.
Talk about a little
I felt like I've seen it.
Hey!
Better than Darkest Hour.
It's the best Neeson season movie since The Grey and the best movie about the financial crisis since The Big Short. That's my pitch. That's my poster movie pitch.
I felt like I'd seen it before because I've seen him on a plane fighting something.
Seen him on
a plane
from the same director on a plane in a taxi on his feet.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
in a yoga studio
on a kayak is the next one.
Downward facing dog.
Tell me that
Alex, let's pitch this.
$70 million with your
there's a check for us on this one.
Yeah. Anyway, at number 6, The Greatest Showman, which I haven't seen yet.
Well, I haven't either.
That seemed to come from nowhere as well. Just suddenly, like...
Yeah, 1.2 million euro.
I don't know, I saw a thing recently saying, how it became a surprise hit. I don't know if it's that much of a surprise. Hugh
Jackman
is massively popular. Musicals kind of have a bit of a...
Well, on the other hand, like, Australia. Like, Jackman's popularity never really translated outside of the X-Men movies,
that's
I would
true.
Argue.
That is true.
But there is a lot of... there's massive pockets of Twitter that I see occasionally chatting about The Great Showman. I can't get enough of the song. Rewatching it.
I was at the
serious
cinema
rewatchability.
I was at the cinema last night seeing Downsizing. And I really regret that I didn't listen to the teenage girls at the stand next to me going, "You have to see The Greatest Showman." Not to me, just
you idiot.
Yeah, you fool, you blew it. I gave you a chance to
I gave you all the clues, Mr. Police.
actually, yeah, that's what Downsizing remind me of. Downsizing is the movie that I wish The Snowman...
By next week's podcast, or next time I'm on, I would have seen The Snowman.
Really?
By God, I can't wait.
And we'll all be coming out of cold. At number five, Early Man.
Oh, the Nick
Park I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. I'll
probably see that.
I went to see something else, but we'll...
It couldn't be as good as Shaun the Sheep, though, right?
Shaun the Sheep's actually really
good. It's great. No, it couldn't be as good. Like, I love Shaun the Sheep.
Like, it's got that sort of World War II thing as well, because it's got that, was it the Great Escape is Chicken Run?
Yeah.
This is, was it Escape to Victory? The one with,
Michael Caine
and Sylvester Stallone.
It has, has the greatest, has the greatest,
that wonderful ensemble.
Sheep backpack joke that slayed me, like the sheep pretends to be the backpack as the sheep.
Yeah.
I was in tears of laughter watching it. I was like, yeah. So
he's really good for visual gags.
Yeah,
which
good.
Is important.
So
I mean, inclination.
It's
pretty crucial.
No, my family went to see it there.
Is that a Claymation one, or is it like that hybrid computer thing?
No, it's Claymation.
I think it's
proper Claymation.
Cool.
Yeah, Ironman still work entirely, don't they?
Well, they did the Pirates.
I like the Pirates,
and I love the
Pirates.
Pirates
was great,
but
that
was kind of like half Claymation.
Yeah, it was.
Was it?
I think it was an American co-production. That's probably what it was.
You want that Paramount money? You've got to make the Paramount.
I like the Pirates, though. It's good fun.
Pirates is great fun.
Yeah.
All the studios are. At number four, the movie I went to see instead of Early Man, Maze Runner, The Death Cure.
You've had a great week, Darren. I feel really bad for seeing Punch Drunk Love and Phantom Thread.
How many of these are there now?
Yeah.
This is the third one. It is the last one that they know. Maze
the Wheat Runner was the second one, and Barley Runner was the first one.
But yeah, it's...
I believe that.
So wait, it's called... Magic thing about is it called The Maze Runner, The Death Cure?
No, it's just Maze Runner, The Death Cure.
Okay.
As if, like...
Next
as,
the...
if, as, as if the character's name is Mr. M. Runner.
Yeah.
But there are no runners. There's no
does
mazes.
Anybody run two mazes?
Yeah, there are. There is no maze
anymore.
Maze
of the mind.
There was a maze, though.
They got out of the maze in the first one. And then, like... I thought that they do something like they have to go back into the maze.
Or
does
it? There's a maze that's four times the size of the original maze that can't be beaten or whatever.
And so
I
they
don't
have
know
to
what they do.
So they have to turn to
the real
like
maze is in your heart.
Yeah. The real maze was the one we walked along the way. It is, yeah. What's amazing though about it is it's ridiculously violent. Like it's,
really?
Like all these, you have this young adult thing, obviously, with the Hunger Games, the Harry Potter, and you got this subtext running through all of them, which is very preoccupied with child soldiers, which is like, and maybe it's because like in the '80s, obviously, you had like Red Dawn and stuff, and you know,
I grew up watching Red Dawn,
see
Thomas Howell and all those.
But because the action
actors.
Now is more visceral and you know, it's sort of more intense, and because PG-13's gotten looser with regard to violence, they feel more aggressive now.
Yeah.
And I remember watching like. The Hunger Games and thinking, this is a weirdly sanitized version of violence. Like, there's an 8-year-old who dies in The Hunger Games with only a tiny bit of blood coming out of one of her mouth.
Mm.
I remember thinking, this is really...
It's like Dunkirk. Sorry, go on. Never resist the chance to stick a knife into Dunkirk is my
But
model.
Don't worry,
go
it
on,
won't
Darren.
Bleed, Jay. But yeah, so... But surprised at the amount of sort of how, like, visceral the Maze Runner is. Like, there's a moment where they run over some anonymous goons in a bus... And the bus and camera bounce.
That's very suggestive.
There's recoil. It's really uncomfortable because it's basically like, you know the way all those other young adult films think they're about child soldiers? Well,
we are really about it.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about this.
We use real child soldiers.
Yeah, I know. But it is because, on one hand, it's more genuine in inverted commas to the premise. Like, it follows the premise to its logical conclusion.
Is it any good, though?
But it's not, no.
No, I didn't think so.
At number three, The Post.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I've seen this. It's fine.
I liked it a lot.
I liked it in that immediately after watching it I was like, gotta go watch All the President's Men.
See, and that's the last scene. That's the hook, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, but also it just reminded me of just so many better films.
Well,
Spotlight
even, for example.
It's kind of like, I have a feeling, like, the thing I always remember about watching Silence of the Lambs is you watch and you're like, fantastic. If only there were more. Oh wait, there are, but it's always so bad. So I don't know. I could see myself watching All the President's Men again because that's a fantastic film. I'd always recommend it. And I think, oh yeah, The Post is actually pretty good. So
The Post is okay.
Yeah,
like it's you feel mean. I feel mean saying things about kind of standard prestige Spielberg.
Yeah.
But
because that's what I like, and it's fine and it's decent.
Yeah.
But it's a tad dull.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, it is. Like,
at the end,
just a little bit.
It's only well made, Jay.
No, you know, this
is
Spielberg with a budget. He should be bloody well made.
Yeah. Oh, journalism is great. It's like, yeah, we know.
Yeah. Well, like, I mean, you don't need a movie to tell you that. Like,
well,
but I quite enjoy having a well made movie that tells me that occasionally.
Well made movie should be the bottom line. Like, it shouldn't be that.
This is why you need to see more bad movies. We're going to see Maze Runner: The Death Cure.
I used to have a Cineworld card. I've seen thousands of bad movies. I am sick of watching deliberately, not deliberately terrible.
Okay,
you know,
double
terrible.
Bill, Darkest Hour, and Maze Runner. You and me,
I would
right?
Kill
you
for
taking him to Darkest Hour. I am not allowing it.
All right, move on.
At number two, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Still there.
Ronan has seen it since
I have
last
now
time.
Gone to see it, and you're not going to like
I'm well aware of what you're going to say. It's Darren versus the world. I'm defending my Three Billboards while you bastards burn them down.
An awful lot.
Yes.
An awful lot of people agree
with
you.
Three Billboards. It's a good film.
I feel like I could space the letters where it's better.
You can just get a cardboard deer instead of a CGI one.
I think an awful lot of people agree with you, and I think we had this conversation last week, that it's the backlash, if you want to call it that, or the negative reception towards it, is very loud, and that obviously becomes the conversation around it. But a lot of people really like it. I just can't understand why. The scene where Frances McDormand explains the themes of the film
to a
CGI
deer,
a very bad CGI deer,
really,
and making jokes
CGI.
About Doritos, I literally head in hands, and what is happening? And I was really, really pleased that the audience I saw it with was on my side, in that a lot of, and I think McDonough is this kind of, he thinks of himself as a provocateur, and he goes for these, you know, ooh, using words that you shouldn't use in your script and all the rest, that kind of Tarantino-esque thing of you know,
pushing the audience getting results.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he just, it never works. It certainly never works for me, and it didn't work for the audience I was with. There were awkward silences at a lot of points where clearly McDonough wants you to laugh, and not happy with the way he uses violence. There are times where I think he's trying to get us laugh at things that ultimately aren't funny. But on top of all that, it's just, I thought it didn't have much going on. You made the point last week, and I agree with you that it's, you know, it's about the kind of corruptive power of anger and how it doesn't get you anywhere. But I think it's very muddled the way the film expresses that.
All right.
It's certainly there, but it doesn't have a lot to say about it.
I think I kind of made a similar point. That I think McDonough brought something to the table, a really good idea, and had no idea what to do with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's where, it's like the setup, the premise, everything. The first 20 minutes, like, okay, I'm in. Show me what you got, and he's got nothing.
Yeah.
That's how I felt about it.
I think he.
I don't think he's not nearly as smart as he thinks he is.
He's not.
Yeah.
He keeps gesturing towards these grander ideas. You know, I think it's something like 5 times within the opening 20 minutes. There's a mention, and not as a joke, of the violence toward black people by cops in America. So you think he's setting this up.
He's
going to
say
something about this.
Nothing.
And he sets up bad punchlines with it, which is just co-opting a serious issue for bad jokes. Which
And I said last night we were talking about this, like, I've no problem with filmmakers using the N-word if they're doing a real, if there's something, you can use whatever word you want. This is not a kind of safe space argument or, kind of idea that you can't, or the censoring about. It's not. I mean, you can say whatever you need to say as long as you can back up with something and a reason for saying it.
Yeah.
And I don't really see, other than being provocative and being, talking about America, it's anything. I don't think that's enough. I mean, I don't think it's anything at all. I think it's actually insulting.
But there's a similar moment where, Sam Rockwell is reading a letter from the Woody Harrelson character that says, you need to get more in touch with your feelings, and don't worry, if anyone calls you a faggot, you can tell them that you can arrest them because that's homophobia. And it's kind of like, that's not even offensive, it's just not funny.
Yeah.
And that's a big problem. It tries to toe that line towards offensiveness, but it's just more often
I
just
watched
not funny.
In Bruges again, I think I watched it when I was a teenager when it first came out, and was like, ho ho ho, along with everyone else, and then I watched it again and it was just like, oh.
I haven't seen it in a long time.
It
does not age well.
I rewatched In Bruges. I really like In Bruges, but I think we've discussed this before as well. I think what In Bruges does, and this is why his fallen films have fallen down. In Bruges has this kind of grand.
But In Bruges is not American. It's not about
No.
No,
but it has this grand kind of idea about heaven, hell, the price you pay for things.
Yeah.
But it's infused throughout the film. And everything that happens has a response or a consequence.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's built into the film. So even logically, even if you don't like it, the script has a logic that follows
that
fits.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then and around that there are funny parts, and I think what the big difference for in Bruges as well is that's two really engaging characters that you can feel empathy and sympathy for, even if you do or not, but it's potentially there.
No,
I don't feel that in Three Billboards, for example, at all, for anyone. Perhaps Woody Harrelson is the only one that really invested with any kind of
okay.
It's kind of sympathetic kind of feeling. And it's not just the cancer. I think he just, he's acting in the film that's a proper drama. Everybody else is acting in the McDonough Tarantino-esque film.
He manages this moment where he kind of says, like, oh, what more can I do? I wish I could do more.
Yeah.
He does add something.
Yeah, he's the only one that actually does something, I think, in the film. And I think, I know you disagree, but I think McDormand, is as great as she is one note, because the character is one note. And I'm not impressed by her performance. I think she's done far better work than this.
I strongly disagree with
that. I know you
do.
I know
you do. We're not going to spend 20 minutes arguing about it. So
but boy, Darren.
I'll let the two guys who have seen it at the floor and let Alex sort of contemplate there whether or not he wants to go and see the film.
I'll think about it.
Enjoy that, Alex. Enjoy.
With this ringing endorsement from this crowd, it's great.
I think in a way, I can't recommend it myself, but it's almost worth seeing. Because
yeah,
it's
yeah,
an
yeah.
interesting
no,
conversation.
I will go
to
see
agree,
it.
I agree.
Even if I hate it, it's something to chat about.
And yell about.
Yeah.
And at number one, Coco, surprising, absolutely.
Hey,
Pixar.
I liked it. And Coco's an interesting one because I saw it last weekend and it was one of those films that the plot and the characters have to do a hell of a lot of heavy lifting in the first hour. Mm-hmm. And so there's a bit of a kind of at arm's length kind of thing with the film.
Yeah.
Where you're kind of, I was like, I don't know about this. This is kind of late period Pixar where you're kind of a little bit worried maybe and you know your characters are fine, the setups are fine, but it there's a lot of plot to be worked in, there's a lot of story to be worked in, a lot of characters to be worked in, but then somewhere around the kind of just after over the halfway mark it clicks and then it really really gets stronger and stronger as it goes to the point where it ends, and it's really beautiful I think, and it really makes its points very well about what it's getting at.
No.
You're going to disagree, aren't you?
I was not as convinced.
Darren's a monster.
I'm a monster with no heart. I'm dead inside.
Yeah.
I like Three Billboards and I don't like Coco. No,
have killed Santa.
I think Coco's grand. I think you're right when you say it's better than a lot of late stage Pixar. It's obviously not a patch on up Inside
it's,
Out. The
it's not a top. It's not top tier
no,
Pixar. But it's a very fine one.
It would be lucky to be top 10, I would argue.
Ooh, I don't know about that, but I'd have to
actually
check
it.
I was going to say
they've done 19.
19.
What? Yeah, I know. There are a lot of
factor in a lot of cars.
Three Toy Stories.
Two Monsters
films.
There's
been 12
cars. Yeah.
You believe that one.
Yeah.
And it's been Absolutely. A Planes, hasn't there?
Planes wasn't Pixar. Planes.
Yeah.
Pixar drew the line of Planes.
Oh, well then, excuse me.
That was
like that's
principle.
That's where they drew their line. We're doing Cars 3.
We're
not doing Planes.
Three Cars Lanes.
That's a step too far.
Yeah, and there were several Planes films as well, starring John Cryer, I believe, if we should be so lucky. But no, I thought it was grand. I thought it wasn't very easy to... I thought it was indistinguishable in large part from the contemporary Disney films. Like, I liked it as much as I liked Mona. I liked Mona a lot. I thought it was, you know, maybe it was better than Frozen. I thought it was as good as Tangled. I wouldn't rank it among, like,
Can
the
I ask you a question?
Canon.
Have you seen it once?
Yes.
I had a conversation with somebody after watching it, and similarly, when I was talking about the kind of the heavy lifting and the work and on the first part of it, I would suspect it may play better a second time in the context of you already know the bit of it, like how the build of it was going. I would imagine, and I'd be very surprised if it didn't play a lot better in the second time around. Just in terms of, I think
you'd
find everything.
Deal, Jay.
Okay, make me a deal.
You watch Three Billboards again, I'll watch Coco again.
Yeah, and in 10 years we'll come back and talk about
yeah,
it.
We'll figure it out. And again, it sounds like I'm being harsh. I quite liked it. I thought it was very good.
Like
I'd recommend
it. It's all right.
Yeah, I'd recommend
it. No, it's good. Fair enough. That's a fair point.
It being a reasonably good Pixar film is not damning it with paint.
No, I agree. And I don't think it's top tier, but I do think it's very good. I very much enjoyed it.
Mm. All right, so very quickly, let's take a look at what's coming out this week. So, let's start with films that I think nobody here has seen, which is Roman Israel Esquire, which is the Denzel Washington
the lawyer
surprise
one.
Oscar nominee.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's because Franco got kicked out. Like,
the thing I'm hearing is that he's very good, but it's a bad film.
Yeah.
And it's from that Tony Gilroy guy?
Dan Gilroy,
yeah. Sorry.
One of the Gilroys.
Gilroy.
The Gilroy gang.
Donald Clark kind of talked about it as saying that it didn't seem ready. Like, as
yeah.
it was
it's
kind of
like first draft.
Yeah, yeah. It was, and I've heard that variations on that a little bit. I like Denzel. I'll always kind of watch anything he's in, generally speaking. Will I see in the cinema? Maybe not, but I will watch it at some point.
A film that'll be like a good Friday night on. Like,
yeah, exactly. I'm all for that.
Yeah, just sort of
stick it in the place mark. Yeah,
have a glass or something and enjoy it. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, no problem.
Also out is Journey's End, which is the an adaptation of Orson Welles' play about World War One.
That's right.
It does apparently have great reviews.
I saw the trailer and it looked kind of like I've already seen it in the last 60 years. But you know, it kind of brings everything together.
Most
and that's
movies
why
he bought in the HMV 5.
Yeah, all 5,000 of them. But yeah. It's got stellar enough reviews actually. It looks pretty good. I might catch this actually at some point in the next week if I can. Because I like a kind of properly done war film, like really done, and it seems to be quite thoughtful from what I read about it, like has a few things to say, and I think it's based on a play, is it?
It is indeed. It's Orson Welles.
Yes, I don't know who that is, but okay, that's fine.
Damn it, Jay! You could just play along.
I could have, but no, I'd reveal my
podcaster Tay.
Hi, I'm Orson Welles. You may remember me from such classics as. I do want to catch it probably.
And then earlier this week, myself and you went to two very different previews of films that are coming out this
week. Yes,
weekend.
We did, Darren.
I suspect I'll go first.
You
so
go
I'll
first.
End on a high note. continuing Darren's trend of having a choice between two films and seeing a terrible one,
oh,
Darren went to go see Den of Thieves, which is the new Jared Butler heat ripoff.
Oh, God.
It's perfectly serviceable. It's Jared Butler playing late stage Al Pacino, and it's a much better fit than you want it to be.
Wow.
Butler is appalling, though.
The what?
Like
he's
a dreadful actor.
He's miscast as himself in Hugo Boss ads.
Yeah.
Like he can't even play himself convincingly. I don't believe it's him. That's how bad he is.
And now he's literally the man of today, if you will.
Yes, indeed, yes.
But yeah, it's very much a reheat, if you will. Stop Cops and Robbers, robs so blatantly from Heat to the point where they lift entire scenes. Like there's a moment of Jared Butler standing on the beach staring out at the ocean, contemplating his like broken marriage and his failed masculinity.
And his terrible acting, I hope.
Hope you've learned a lesson.
I might watch this on the Saturday night. This sounds like a Saturday night terrible movie.
It's no snowman. It's no downsizing.
With Jared Butler, if he's looking at the sea, he's contemplating nothing but the sea. That's Jared Butler.
Where is the horizon? Whoa.
Yeah. Mind blown.
But when you go there, it still keeps going.
Hey.
I've never liked Jared
Me
Butler.
Me neither. He's terrible.
I don't know. Yeah, I can't think of the Jared Butler performance.
No, I know.
Defend Jared Butler.
Yeah. 300 is usually where people go.
No, but I mean,
I've heard that.
You're not watching 300 for the performances, right?
I'm not watching 300.
But yeah, and it's great.
Although I have seen 300. It's a bad film.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, I think
Den of Thieves is like, it's a reasonable sort of, it's on television and you can't reach the remote.
I think that's it. Sky Premier, you have to stumble upon the Friday night. Stick it on.
Go with it, yeah. And it's great because like the film spends so much of the movie stealing from Heat that it's practically like a surprise twist at the end of the movie when they steal from another very recognisable iconic film.
I hope it's Don't Look Now.
It's the one you exactly think it is. It's the one anybody listening to this movie thinks it is. Let's be honest here.
Right.
But yeah, so that was how I spent my Tuesday night.
What was the other film then you went to? Or what
well,
you...
Jay will tell you in a moment about the film that he went to on Tuesday night.
I saw Phantom Thread. I know you do.
Was it as good as a Jared Butler Heat remake?
Well, one wouldn't know how to compare. One simply wouldn't have the tools to compare such things. Myself and Philip went to see it actually on Tuesday, who was doing the review for Scanon. The comeback. Philip, not me. I really, really liked it. I was obviously, I guess, predisposed to like it because, you know, I'm a PTA fan. It's a very interesting film in that they lose his nominally the lead, but he's largely sidelined and I think to his point of view he's happy enough, like in the sense that he's there all the time but he's not the centre of attention for a lot of it, and I think he's happy enough to do that. He seems to be having a ball in it, which is fine because the two performances that he has alongside him, which is Leslie Manville as his sister Cyril and Vicky Cripps, who is sensational as his kind of new partner. But he this kind of starts off this thing where he has girlfriends and, you know, he tires of them and then his sister gets rid of them. That's his whole thing. He's confirmed bachelor, swan about London in the kind of 50s, 60s. So he kind of meets her in the kind of country and he brings her back to London to kind of be his new muse or whatever. That's the kind of your standard setup kind of thing.
Mm.
But that obviously goes off in different directions. I don't want to say too much. I think it's it gets that interest in weird little things. It's a strangely kinky movie,
mm-hmm.
in the way it kind of pitches the kind of male versus female, classic male ego kind of.
Yeah,
I'm not quite sure if it's not necessarily toxic masculinity as such, but it's kind of
the male artist.
Yeah,
the
ego and the kind of, you know, I'm in charge of everything, and you know.
Well, Anderson was inspired to make the film based on one day when he was sick and he was fevered in bed, and Maya Rudolph had to care for him because she's his wife, not because she randomly happened to be around. But he was basically, that's where he got the inspiration. Where he got this idea of how what it feels like to be cared for in that capacity.
I think that's interesting, and I think there's an element of being a kept man that a lot of men would like to break away from their kind of, I don't necessarily kind of exist in a large scale now, but certainly back in the day of, you know, the being a kind of pre-assigned role in society, you're X. And as I think back then, particularly, there was a lot of men would actually kill not to be that. You don't have to be that. You don't have any interest in it. It's not about this. You can actually live your life without being a kind of big male character. And it kind of does set fire to that kind of thing a little bit. And I think Anderson probably, I think I've read a little bit, kind of subconsciously kind of dismantled the idea of that kind of artist as.
Yeah.
And he's been doing it a little bit for years, I would argue. Like, and there was
the master.
New ground for him in that regard. But how it's done is very, very impressive. Anderson is his own cinematographer in this.
Yeah,
and
he couldn't get Paul Elvis.
Some of his shots are, like, he knows how to move a camera. Like, he knows how to move a camera. And he knows how to move a camera. Like, they're really beautiful. The film gets kind of very odd. There's a couple of missteps in the second half. Some minor ones. I expect they'll smooth out in a rewatch. But the first half is a delight. It's fast-paced, funny. And the film is really funny. Like, I laughed a lot. It's smart. It's intelligent. The women characters, the two characters, Manville and Crepes, are fabulous. They own the film. Like, they really do. And the camera's drawn to them all the time. The film is drawn to them all the time. Day-Lewis is drawn to them all the time. But he's helpless in a lot of sense, both in acting. And Day-Lewis is great. He's really great in this. But he's happy to play alongside. Kind of, I'm watching people do their thing in the kind of more showier roles, I think. It's very hard to get into specifics, so I don't want to say too much about it. But
don't you dare.
In the second half, it does some very interesting things that you wouldn't necessarily expect. A couple of moments where it kind of signposts them a little too heavily, but that's fine. But do see it. I mean, if you like Anderson, you're going to like it. If you don't, if you're coming to Anderson, you're a bit sketchy about him, this probably won't convince you. It's kind of, you know, it's in doing its thing, but there's lots to enjoy, even if you're not a huge Anderson fan in there.
I'm curious, how do you think it's going to play? Because they've spent a fortune marketing it. I feel like I've seen the trailer about 30 times.
Yeah. I think it'll play well here. And I think in the UK, I think the same, probably better in the UK. And plus it's set in England as well. I think
Oscar nominee.
It's the first time I think Anderson's gone outside in quite a while. It's the first time he shot outside California, or set a film outside California since Hard Eight.
Yeah.
Which is set in Nevada.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is the first time he shot it. It's not shot, but he's made a film set primarily.
I think it'll do well. I think it's already kind of crept up the amount of screenings post Oscars in America. It's done okay. I don't think they were hoping for a little bit of more of an extra bump, I think.
Yeah.
But I think it'll play better internationally. I think Anderson probably does to some degree.
I mean, it performed much better at the Academy Awards than people expected.
Oh, yeah, it did. Yeah. I mean, I've no argument for Best Director getting in there. I think Creeps.
Well, I mean, given the alternative was McDonagh.
Yeah, I was very happy. I would like to see Reason there as well, but yeah, that's fine.
No, I mean,
Creeps, I think, should have got into the conversation for Best Actress. I think she's great. Manville is in there for Best Supporting Actress and absolutely deserves. Day-Lewis for Actor.
Johnny Greenwood.
And Greenwood's score is, it's used a lot, but it's a lot different than I was expecting. I hadn't heard anything of Philip had been listening a little bit, so he's a bit more aware of it. It's much more strained, like in terms of it's very much his cues are more old school and classical kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's very beautiful.
And
really plays
the music too.
I think so. And it plays beautifully with the scenes. Like it's married perfectly because they have such an arrangement now. Like it's kind of synchronized kind of thing. Perfect. But I'll very much recommend it.
I'm also informed that Phil's review is up on Scan at the moment.
Oh.
So, dear listener, you can browse on your phone now.
Rush on.
read while we're on.
Very good.
In the meantime, so we're going to wrap things up, but where can we find the rest of you guys online, actually? If people want a bit more, you know, Ronan, Jay, and Alex in their lives.
Get me on Twitter at Baron Ronan.
I do some light stalking on Twitter at Jay Coyle, and occasionally on Scanon and Cindy Aaron.
I have a podcast called When Irish Eyes Are Watching, where we chat about films, particularly Irish films, and it has a Twitter handle, which is something like WIEAW
initials,
podcast.
Yes.
Yeah, I hope that's it.
You really should know it more convincingly than that.
It's been very hard to at you.
Yeah.
It's been a hard handle to manage.
It's
a hard handle to break.
Yeah.
No, it's good. I've listened to it. It's good. I'd highly recommend
as well. All right, take it easy, guys, and we'll be back next week. Cheers.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks.